The headlines: U.S. President Donald Trump pardons four Blackwater contractors who were given lengthy prison terms for massacring Iraqi civilians in 2007. Iran's president says the U.S. has failed to achieve its goal of bringing down the Islamic Republic through sanctions. And scuffles break out between police in England's port of Dover. And truckers stranded after France shut its border to Britain over a highly infectious coronavirus variant. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: U.S. President Donald Trump has pardoned four security guards from a private military firm who were convicted of killing 14 Iraqi civilians in 2007. Trump granted full clemency to the former Blackwater contractors who were serving lengthy prison sentences. They've been convicted on charges of opening fire on unarmed people and voluntary manslaughter in Iraq. At the sentencing, the U.S. Attorney's Office said the guards' actions resulted in a sheer amount of unnecessary human loss. The group's massacre of Iraqi civilians also set off an international uproar over the use of private contractors in war zones. However, the guard supporters argue that they have been excessively punished. Trump has already granted presidential pardons to other officials and military personnel during his final days in office. Author and political commentator John White says U.S. President Donald Trump's pardoning of the convicted Blackwater guards is a foul disfigurement of justice for the Iraqi people.
The Iraq war, it was not a war to liberate the Iraqi people and bring them democracy. It was a war to dominate them and steal their resources. These men are racist killers, and this is a foul disfigurement of justice for the Iraqi people, who have had very little of saying in these last 20 years or so. Donald Trump, we know, is a racist president. He has very little regard for the lives of black and brown people, both at home and abroad, and he knows that this will play well with his base as he gets ready to depart. His base being this white, flag-waving, gun-toting, militia-minded ingrates that he has appealed to and he has done best to whip up throughout his presidency. It's no accident also that it was at the behest of then-Vice President Joe Biden in 2015 that the prosecution of these men was reopened after a federal judge initially threw the prosecution out. So this serves the purpose of embarrassing Joe Biden. It's a sad day for justice, it's a sad day for the Iraqi people. And yet again, we see the results of a racist war. Civilians killed. No justice, no peace.
Russia says it does not expect anything good from U.S. President-elect Joe Biden and his future administration members. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov accused the Biden team of what he called Russia phobia. He said Russia will not initiate any contacts with Biden's transition staff and make any unilateral concessions. Ryabkov told Russian media that his country should rather take a total containment approach in relations with the U.S. He said if the U.S. continues approaching Russia as a strategic rival, Moscow would treat it in a similar way. Biden has blamed Russia for a recent cyber attack in the U.S. He's promised to retaliate once he takes office on January the 20th. Iran's president says his American counterpart has failed to achieve his goals through an economic war waged against the Islamic Republic. Hassan Rouhani called U.S. President Donald Trump a crazy man who sought to topple the Islamic establishment in Iran. Rouhani said the Iranian nation ousted Trump with its resistance. He also said Trump was isolated even by U.S. traditional allies in Europe over his policy on Iran. The outgoing American president imposed tough sanctions on Tehran after walking out of a multilateral nuclear deal in 2018. President-elect Joe Biden has promised to rejoin the deal and seek diplomacy with Iran. Foreign policy analyst Paulina Aniftu says Trump's policy of sanctions against Tehran failed because the West does not have a good understanding of Iran.
The United States, they're isolated about their foreign policy in Middle East, and the Middle East foreign policy of the United States is the main axis of their policy. It is their main pillar of their foreign policy. But what we need to understand in this case is that the West doesn't have a very good understanding of Iran. What the United States, they tried to do with the assistance, of course, of Israel and some European powers is that they believe that if they go along with the sanctions to Iran, Iran is going to collapse. We're going to have a change of government and a regimental change. What they don't understand is that Iran is a very self-sufficient economy, so in the case even of a war, Iranians are going to have water, is going to have food, they are going to have milk, something that does not exist into the Western economies.
The U.S. has imposed new sanctions on Syria targeting its central bank and several other entities. Key advisors of President Bashar al-Assad as well as his wife are among those blacklisted. The U.S. also imposed sanctions on Assad and his wife Asma in June. Washington accuses Asma of using her charities and civil society organizations to consolidate Damascus. To consolidate Damascus's political and economic power, rather, the U.S. has so far imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Syrian government, accusing it of cracking down on its people. Damascus has dismissed the accusation. It says the U.S. Measures target ordinary Syrians and hamper an ongoing reconstruction process following years of conflict. Activist and commentator Mimi Alam believes the U.S. policy on Syria will remain unchanged regardless of who heads the White House.
I think that the U.S. essentially is indicating that it's, you know, whoever the new administration is, or since they're moving from the Trump administration to a Biden administration, that they're continuing their efforts in Syria regardless. And when I say efforts, I mean they're plan to destroy Syria. Since they can't put military pressure on Assad, other than occupying the northeast of the country and controlling the oil resources, they're placing sanctions. So essentially what they're trying to do is starve Syrians into submission. And what they want is for Syria to agree to a constitution that would create a Kurdistan and allow the U.S. to remain inside Syria permanently. And Syria is never going to do that. So unfortunately, this means that it's an indication that the U.S. is not ready to pull out of Syria, and they're going to have to do something to force them to pull out of Syria.
The UN General Assembly has adopted a resolution urging Israel to halt demolishing and confiscating Palestinian homes in the occupied territories. The resolution, among other things, urged Israel to cease destroying civilian and vital infrastructure in the occupied territories. The General Assembly adopted the measure following a report by one of its committees on the situation in those territories. Rights groups say a large number of Palestinians have been displaced this year as a result of continued Israeli demolitions. The regime says it destroys the structures that lack construction permits. Palestinians reject this. They say the demolitions are aimed at expanding Israeli settlements that are illegal under international law. Political commentator Mick Napier says the UN resolution against the Israeli demolition drive does not address the main problem, which is an ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians.
Another resolution of Israel's criminal behavior. It joins an exceedingly long list of condemnations of many aspects of Israeli full-spectrum ethnic cleansing against the native Palestinian people. The Israeli excuse is not worth taking seriously, and anyone who pretends to do so is either a fool or a rogue. The problem for the UNGA is twofold. One, the issue is not house demolitions. The Israelis demolish Palestinian houses all the time. Not only do they do it routinely, but they're so sadistic sometimes, they force Palestinians to demolish their own homes under threat of an enormous penalty if they don't. But that's not the problem. The problem is, if you will the end, you will the means. And the end in this case is a Palestine without Palestinians, open to Jews or people who claim to be Jews from all over the world. These are means towards the end of removing Palestinians from Palestine. So when the UNGA calls for the cessation of this particular crime, it's useful, it alerts people to what's going on, but it doesn't identify the problem, which is an ethnic cleansing regime.
Scuffles have broken out between truck drivers and police in England's coastal town of Dover. The truck drivers demanded to cross to France. A group of them began bullying police, and some started pushing officers to break through their lines. Several thousands of truck drivers, many from across Europe, have been stuck for days in southern England. That comes as the UK struggling with a new COVID-19 variant proved to spread faster. UK and French governments have now reached a deal to reopen their border from Wednesday if the drivers test negative for COVID. Amina Taylor joins us now from the British capital, London. Amina, welcome to the program. What's going on over there in Dover?
Well, I think it's where being ill-prepared meets a little bit of scaremongering and perhaps some ineptitude, frankly, about it. Because when the Prime Minister announced these new changes on Saturday, in an effort to placate the public and to give them an idea here that his government was left with no choice, both himself and England's chief medical officer, Professor Chris Whitty, really spoke about just how dangerous this new variant of COVID-19 was and the way in which they had to essentially lock down London and great swathes of southeast England because they didn't want it spreading outside this tier. Now, if you were the French government or a government on the other side of the English Channel, and you heard this news about, frankly, this new variant of COVID-19 that was 70% more infectious, would you not want to close down your borders in an attempt to try and keep whatever this new issue is on the British side? And that's essentially what's happened here. We have a situation where there isn't enough preparedness in terms of off-ramps and so on for these truck drivers who've been caught up in this situation. And there was no plan B in terms of what I can see being some kind of cross-continental preparedness. So had this been announced perhaps earlier, or had other governments been made aware, perhaps the full scale of the issue, they could have come up with this as a plan A instead of, quite frankly, scrambling to try and find a way in which freight can cross without trying to amplify how this new COVID variant crosses alongside it, Fadia.
And just briefly, if you may tell us a little bit more about what are the reactions specifically among the British public with regards to the discovery of this new variant?
Well, I think there is a lot of not just people being really, really calm about this, because they understand the very basics of some kind of genetic or virology training here, that there are always going to be mutations in a virus. And if we are adhering to the policies, space, face, hands, and keeping our distance, then of course we'll not just keep the old COVID strain at bay, but this one as well. But I think the way in which Tier 4 was announced and we're seeing the different reactions from international governments, people are wondering, what, should we be worried here? Should there be something else that we're not being told? And I think it's clear when we've done vox pops on this issue, it's a case of people being alarmed but calm.
Thanks a lot, Amina Taylor, joining us from London. Daily coronavirus deaths in Germany has hit a new record with 962 fatalities registered in the past 24 hours. The figure posted Wednesday brings total COVID deaths in Germany to nearly 28,000. December has been the deadliest month there since the pandemic began. The country registered at least 10,000 deaths in the first 3 weeks of December. That was nearly double November's fatality toll. The virus has surged despite a partial lockdown in place since early November. The country has now tightened that lockdown for a week and says it could remain in place until at least January 10th. So far, more than 1.5 million people have got COVID-19 in Germany. Iran has reported 153 new deaths from coronavirus. That's the lowest daily fatality number there since November 21st. According to the health ministry, the latest figure pushes Iran's total COVID deaths to over 54,000 out of more than 1.1 million. Daily cases and fatalities from the pandemic have been declining in Iran for a month now. That's because of a partial lockdown which has been in place across the country. Officials, however, say the situation is fragile and people should strictly follow health protocols. Meanwhile, Health Minister Saeed Namaki has said that There's been no trace of the newly identified COVID strain in Iran. U.S. President Donald Trump has rejected a $900 billion bipartisan COVID stimulus package. He says it does not address concerns caused by the pandemic.
It really is a disgrace. For example, among the more than 5,000 pages in this bill, which nobody in Congress has read because of its length and complexity, it's called the COVID Relief Bill, but it has almost nothing to do with COVID.
While Trump did not explicitly say he would not sign the bill, he made clear he would not accept the legislation. He asked Congress to eliminate what he called unnecessary items from the legislation and send him a suitable one. The president demanded lawmakers more than triple relief payments to Americans. The bill was passed overwhelmingly by both chambers of Congress on Monday after months of political wrangling. The package includes jobless programs and supports U.S. businesses battered by the pandemic. A bomb attack has targeted a police car on the outskirts of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Local media say a policeman was killed and two others were injured after their car was hit by a roadside bomb. No further details are available. There has been no claim of responsibility either. Violence has surged in Afghanistan in the past few months, especially in the capital, Kabul. A tally shows more than 130 people have been killed in the city over the past 2 months. The surge comes as the government is in talks with Taliban militants for a peace deal. In the past 2 months, media representatives in Afghanistan have tolerated heavy losses as several journalists have been targeted in terrorist attacks in the country. The recent wave of the attacks on media staff has raised concerns about the safety of the journalists amid the growing violence in the country. Amin Alami has more from Kabul.
Media workers have recently been a target for the violent attacks in Afghanistan. Afghan government has strongly and repeatedly condemned targeting media, blaming the Taliban militant group for such attacks. This is why the militants have largely rejected involvement in attacks against the journalists. Seven journalists were killed in 2019, and now official figures say at least 14 journalists have lost their lives in 2020, six of them killed only over the past 2 months. The Afghan government says it has arrested some figures who are involved in some cases of attacks on journalists. Government officials say one of the main causes behind terrorists' focus on targeting media activists is to hide their defeats in the battlefields.
Terrorists are after hiding their defeats in the battlefields by planting roadside bombs and killing Afghan civilians, including journalists. The Afghan security and defense forces have recently arrested some of those who were behind planting IEDs and targeting civilians.
In the meantime, media rights activists believe the government has failed to protect journalists against death threats coming either from terrorist groups, influential figures, and local commanders.
The rising violence against journalists in Afghanistan has increased our concerns. We are not safe even in big cities like Kabul, and this is because of government's low attention to this problem. In this case, we want the government to let us protect ourselves by our own measures.
Media rights bodies and journalists consider the emergence and growth of media in Afghanistan as a great achievement. They believe the Afghan government has to take strict measures to put an end to the violence against journalists, who are in fact the frontline soldiers of press freedom. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Well, that's a wrap for now. Goodbye, everybody.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The COVID-19 pandemic has accentuated and, in fact, accelerated the sharp inequalities that exist in every society individually and the world at large. According to a June 2020 study conducted in the United States by the Brookings Institute, the number of deaths as a result of the disease reflects a clear racial logic. Many indicators included in the study leave no doubt that racism is a central factor in the life cycle of COVID. For example, among those aged between 45 and 54 years, Black and Hispanic Latino death rates are at least 6 times higher than for whites. Although whites make up 62% of the U.S. population of that specific age group, only 20% of the total deaths were white. Black and Latino communities were the most devastated. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Ramsey Barwood Ryder. This article is published under the heading The Great Divider. COVID-19 reflects global racism, not equality. Here's the details of this article. The notion that the COVID-19 pandemic was the great equalizer should be dead and buried by now. If anything, the lethal disease is another terrible reminder of the deep divisions and inequalities in societies. That said, the treatment of the disease should not be a repeat of the same shameful scenario. For an entire year, wealthy celebrities and government officials have been reminding people that we are in this together and we are on the same boat. Such statements have generated much media attention, not just because they are both famous people with a massive social media following, but also because of the obvious hypocrisy in their empty rhetoric. In truth, however, they were only repeating the standard procedure followed by governments, celebrities, and wealthy influencers worldwide. With unemployment rates skyrocketing across the US and the globe, hundreds of millions scraping by to feed their children, multitudes of nameless and hapless families chugging along without access to proper health care, subsisting on hope and a prayer so that they may survive the scourges of poverty, let alone the pandemic, one cannot, with a clear conscience, make such outrageous claims. According to World Bank data, nearly half of the world lives on less than $5.5 a day. This dismal statistic is part of a remarkable trajectory of inequality that has afflicted humanity for a long time. The plight of many of the world's poor is compounded in the case of war refugees, the double victims of state terrorism and violence, and the unwillingness of those with the resources to step forward and pay back some of their largely undeserved wealth. The boat metaphor is particularly interesting in the case of refugees. Millions of them have desperately tried to escape the infernos of war and poverty in rickety boats and dinghies, hoping to get across from their stricken regions to safer places. This sight has sadly grown familiar in recent years, not only throughout the Mediterranean Sea, but also in the other bodies of water around the world, especially in Burma, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have tried to escape their ongoing genocide. Thousands of them have drowned in Bay of Bengal. The COVID-19 pandemic has accentuated and, in fact, accelerated the sharp inequalities that exist in every society individually and the world at large. According to a June 2020 study conducted in the United States by the Brookings Institute, the number of deaths as a result of the disease reflects a clear racial logic. Many indicators included in the study leave no doubt that racism is a central factor in the life cycle of COVID. For example, among those aged between 45 and 54 years, Black and Hispanic Latino death rates are at least 6 times higher than for whites. Although whites make up 62% of the U.S. population of that specific age group, only 22% of the total deaths were white. Black and Latino communities were the most devastated. According to this and other studies, the main assumption behind the discrepancy of infection and death rates resulting from COVID among various racial groups in the U.S. is poverty, which is itself an expression of racial inequality. The poor have no or limited access to proper health care. For the rich, this factor is of little relevance. Moreover, poorer communities tend to work in low-paying jobs in the service sector, where social distancing is nearly impossible. With little government support to help them survive the lockdowns, they do everything within their power to provide for their children, only to be infected by the virus or, worse, die. This inequality is expected to continue even in the way that the vaccines are made available. While several Western nations have either launched or scheduled their vaccination campaigns, the poorest nations on Earth are expected to wait for a long time before life-saving vaccines are made available. In 67 poor or developing countries located mostly in Africa and the Southern Hemisphere, only 1 out of 10 individuals will likely receive the vaccine by the end of 2020, the Fortune magazine website reported. The disturbing report cited a study conducted by Humanitarian and Rights Coalition, the People's Vaccine Alliance, PVA, which includes Oxfam and Amnesty International. If there is such a thing as a strategy at this point, it is the deplorable hoarding of the vaccine by rich nations. Dr. Moga Kamalyani of PVA put this realization into perspective when she said that rich countries have enough doses to vaccinate everyone nearly 3 times over, while poor countries don't even have enough to reach health workers and people at risk. So much for the numerous conferences touting the need for a global response to the disease. But it does not have to be this way. While it is likely that class, race, and gender inequalities will continue to ravage human societies after the pandemic, as they did before, it is also possible for governments to use this collective tragedy as an opportunity to bridge the inequality gap, even if just a little, as a starting point to imagine a more equitable future for all of us. Poor, dark-skinned people should not be made to die when their lives can be saved by a simple vaccine, which is available in abundance.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Inside Israel.
Israel normalized ties with the UAE, Sudan, and Bahrain this year. Israeli media is saying that there was a shadowy agreement between Netanyahu and the United Arab Emirates prior to the normalization deal. It says that this might be similar to Netanyahu's submarine scandal with Germany.
There is no base to say that there was any secret negotiations on this issue. There was no condition on behalf of the UAE to sell them F-35s as part of the peace deal. Only after the deal was signed, the Americans told us we should consider this matter.
In that case, close aides and friends of his were involved in bribery for the purchase of submarines and missile-equipped boats. In this case, however, it was convincing Netanyahu's ally in the White House, U.S. President Donald Trump, to sell the Emirates F-35 warplanes. Not everyone's happy about the deal. Many in Israel believe that selling F-35 warplanes to the UAE gives it a military edge that only Israel enjoys. And the Arab Israelis believe the so-called Abraham Accords, also known as the normalization deal, are apartheid in nature. It seems that at home in Israel, Netanyahu isn't being totally honest about his normalization deals with Arab countries. Israeli media shine light on the fact that Netanyahu has given his agreement to U.S. the sale of F-35 fighter jets to the UAE as a big incentive for the country to sign a peace deal with Israel. At first, these claims were dismissed and labeled by Netanyahu and his supporters as fake news. But he recently admitted that the U.S. is planning to sell the advanced aircrafts to Abu Dhabi, and Israel will not object. Netanyahu, in his defense, claimed the arms deal between the U.S. and the UAE was made after the normalization agreement had been signed. Israeli military minister Benny Gantz, however, implied that Netanyahu lied to the Israeli military and the negotiations over the normalization deal, which included the sale of the jets, had been conducted behind the backs of Israel's defense establishment. Opposition lawmaker and former military minister Moshe Yaalon said the same thing happened during the purchase of submarines from Germany, with Netanyahu completely ignoring the defense ministry's opinion on the matter. It should be noted that this submarine affair with Germany is a big deal in Israel. The high-profile Case 3000 investigation has accused several close associates of Netanyahu, but not the premier himself, on suspicion that they received illicit funds as part of a massive graft scheme in the multi-billion shekel purchase of naval vessels and submarines from German shipbuilder ThyssenKrupp. Some have called it the largest suspected graft scandal in Israel's history. Israeli prosecutors are reportedly considering opening yet another criminal graft investigation against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, this time in the so-called submarine affair, citing dramatic new information.
I think the price of Israel wasn't, how to say that? There, if you think about what they did in the agreement, it's to make a solidarity between these three countries and Israel, and even Sudan were inside this this solidarity with America, and all against Iran. This is the main issue in these agreements, but. Other thing that it was declared for the people in Israel, for example, or maybe the people in these countries, that it is agreement for business or for other things. I think that Netanyahu needs the business, or the Israel needs the business between these countries and Israel. But moreover, they want to make a price for Trump, who is now out, and Netanyahu to say that we did something in this time, and to give legitimation for the F-25 war airplanes, or how you say it, it's about selling these airplanes for these countries. Because Netanyahu has trouble with his people about the similar deal with Germany about you know the submarines and missile equipment boats, which was secret until they discovered it, and he couldn't make this deal for Egypt and Germany and agree with this deal. So now he has the legitimation about these deals also between Emirates and USA.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Heisenberg says maybe Netanyahu can sell the invisible planes with invisible money. Pierre says it was never a peace plan. Thompson says he will support the sale to give all parties the ability to defend its sovereignty, or Israel can return the advanced weapon systems the U.S. gave Israel.
The leadership that will make a real democracy, not what's happening right now, that he kills all the democratic institutes and he makes what he wants like a king, and that's what we are against.
I think what has happened is that Israel normalized relations with Bahrain and the UAE and Sudan, and now also Morocco, because it's part of the United States reactionary alliance. The U.S. wants to have an alliance of states that are with it militarily, primarily militarily, and then also economically. So you have countries like the United States, Israel, Bahrain, the UAE, countries like Brazil, countries like Hungary, some of the European countries. They're joined together in what I think of as a very reactionary alliance of the most backward states when it comes to political morality. Netanyahu may have objected at first to the sale of F-35s to the UAE, but he knows, and the United States knows, that Israel has nuclear weapons. First of all, this is basically this alliance is good for all of them for military sales. It's a sales alliance. It's going to boost military sales monumentally. Secondly, these states cannot possibly attack Israel or become more militarily superior to Israel because they don't have nuclear weapons.
Netanyahu is also under fire for striking a normalization deal with Sudan at the behest of the U.S. taking Sudan off its list of terrorism sponsors. Sudan has been under sanctions, and by removing it from the list, Sudan would be relieved of its financial burdens and can trade freely with the U.S. and other countries. Sudan believes that it is the biggest winner of the deal. According to Sudan, Khartoum would have had to wait a year to be delisted as state sponsor of terrorism, says General Abdel Fattah Burhan, head of the ruling Sovereign Council. For Netanyahu's right-wing supporters, the normalization with Arab countries can cost them greatly. First of all, Netanyahu has promised that he will not for the time being annex the occupied West Bank, which was a major campaign promise. He had wanted to annex it and promised to do so for years, despite public outcry from the international community. From the Israeli rights perspective, the main purpose of these agreements is to solidify its power and to further weaken the Palestinian struggle against occupation and apartheid. The Israeli Arabs reflect on this because they are treated as second-class citizens. In fact, the so-called nation-state law institutionalized racism and apartheid against Israeli Arabs. They believe that the Abraham Accords are essentially an alliance of Israel with its apartheid against Palestinians, Bahrain and its Saudi-backed Sunni oppression of the Shia majority, and the UAE, where 1 million Emirati citizens live with 8 million foreigners with no rights.
As I said, it is apartheid countries. They are not democratic. They have people there as a second level citizens or something like this. So when they make these deals without talking about Palestinians' problems, Palestinian-Israeli conflict, not talking about having a solution also for these agreements, and also Israel has the Arab-Palestinian, and after the law, nation, country law, which make the Arab-Palestinian-Israeli citizens in a second level, it's, you know, like making legitimation for this apartheid regime. It's putting the... it's saying for the whole world, okay, here we have in Bahrain, in Emirates, in Saudi, we have also like these people who we can treat Israeli Palestinian citizens the same. They can't sign it. They can't. They can't support it because it's they. It didn't speak about a solution for the Palestinian. It didn't speak about the nation country law, which make the Palestinian people in Israel as other citizens, Jewish citizens. So they can't. They didn't sign it. They don't agree with it. Okay, we know about these agreements under the law, but now when it's under the table, and now when it is on the table and need the support of the lawmakers, there is many differences between these agreements. In the deal of the century, there were talks about the solution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Was this solution fair for the Palestinian or not? But the Palestinian conflict was in the middle of this agreement. And the agreement between Emirates, Saudi, Bahrain, and Israel and Sudan, there was nothing about Palestinians. Also, what is similar between them, and if there is something secret or shadowy about Palestinian, in both agreements, Palestinians are not part of these agreements. They don't share, they don't support, they don't have any idea about what is going between them, and then they want the Palestinian to accept it.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Juana says normalization with Israel is to recognize the right of the thief who stole your brother's house, expelled him and his family to the street, and you open your house to rob you too and expel you with your family later. Motherland says shame on these countries that normalize with Israel. CC Cannon says I think you better start backing as far away as possible from the corrupt Trump administration.
If you just go back to 2018 and look at Israel's nation state law that was passed in the Knesset, what we see is a law that says Jews alone have the right of self-determination within Israel, whose boundaries are not defined in this law, and that Jews alone can settle the land as a form of almost spiritual national redemption. In addition, it makes Hebrew the official language of Israel and relegates Arabic to a secondary status. That means Palestinians living within Israel proper, as it's called, as well as in the Palestinian territories that are occupied, these people are they're not just second-class citizens. They're third, fourth, or fifth class citizens. They do not have equal rights with the Jewish Israeli public. They have no right to self-determination. They have no right to settle land owned primarily by the State of Israel, the Jewish National Fund. They have no right to make Arabic the primary language of their daily lives. I mean, it is the primary language, but it's considered secondary.
Some compare the Abraham Accords with the nation-state law that was passed in 2018 by the Israeli Knesset. Many compare it to legalizing apartheid, as it legally made all Arab citizens second-class citizens. Just last July, Israeli Knesset rejected an amendment to the racist nation-state law to include a clause guaranteeing the equality of all citizens. Israelis now feel that Netanyahu lied to them and that they're giving up too much instead of what they were promised, nothing for normalization with Arab countries. Israelis have always sought recognition and acceptance from the Arab world without reciprocity. Can Netanyahu admit the real price of normalization for Israel? That's one question Netanyahu's opponents in Israel are asking. Here is the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News. Israel's coronavirus czar says a third Israel lockdown definitely on the agenda. Israel's new coronavirus czar, Professor Nachman Ash, said that Israel should prepare for at least another year of dealing with the pandemic, warning that a third lockdown is definitely on the agenda. The Jerusalem Post. A young couple from Beersheba experiencing financial difficulties due to the coronavirus pandemic allegedly turned their apartment into a warehouse for storing drugs and weapons. Israel police investigators uncovered various weapons and explosive devices in their apartment. They also found other substances, including dozens of bags suspected to contain marijuana, and a digital scale that raised the suspicion of drug trafficking as well. The Times of Israel. Protesters demand Supreme Court allow launch of official probe into massive graft scandal that has ensnared Netanyahu associates. The affair, also known as Case 3000, revolves around allegations of a massive bribery scheme in the multi-billion shekel state purchase of the naval vessels from German shipbuilder ThyssenKrupp. The case has already resulted in indictments against several close associates of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as high-ranking military officials, but not the premier himself. Globes. IBM Israel is laying off dozens of employees in its sales division. The cutbacks come just 6 months after the company shed dozens of employees from its development center in Tel Aviv as part of a reorganization of the company's storage products. The latest cuts are also part of a global streamlining process in which thousands of jobs are being cut worldwide.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.